My name is Denny Miles, and the reason that we're having this session is that I wrote an email to the program coordinator, Cindy, who's not here this week, and said, are the Unfolders having a reunion because it's the 50th anniversary? And she said, what's an Unfolder? And I said, well, Unfolder was the name given to the group that started off the work camping in 1962. And she said, well, I thought those were the Forerunners. And I said, no, that was 1961. And then we're also the Undertakers. And the, you know, there were other names of groups that came in. And so this was all new. And she said, you know, we've got to have you do a program on this. Do you have materials? And I said, well, I'm a pack rat. And I have a tremendous number of materials. Contrary to what our host said here, that they're not slides. They're just black and white snapshots. But they are photographs. And I got stories. And I'm a natural storyteller, not necessarily a good storyteller, but a natural storyteller. Who am I since then? Well, I went to Pacific Lutheran University, and they kept me from flunking out. I graduated from Oregon State University, and then came back to the faculty of Oregon State, and was an instructor of cinematography, which was back when they used film. That gives you an idea, again, of how old I was in 1962. And then went and also did some public relations there, worked for a governor as his press secretary in Oregon for 8 years, and did some transition consulting with a governor in Nebraska, and a United States senator in Nebraska, and then was a consultant. You know, and you know what those guys are. They basically tell you what time it is by using your watch. Did that for many, many years. Raised a lot of money, did a lot of fundraising, both political and nonprofit work for humane societies and colleges and universities and community colleges. So I've had a great career, now retired, and I really, I guess, want to start by giving you that, because a lot of that is because of some of the youth programs that I went through in my church, to and including my experience here at Holden Village. I was very young, very immature. I'm not young any longer. And a lot of things were picked up from a lot of really nice people that I interacted with here, some of whom were the adult leaders and some of whom were simply my colleagues. So, 17 years old, Holden Village work camper, 50 years ago. There'll be some personal kind of memoirs things, just kind of recollections and stories that that may or may not be interesting, but they may in fact illuminate or give you a better understanding of some of the history. If you've read any of the, there's only a couple pieces of books out there that have been written in terms of the history, and some of the things in there are, in my, from my experience, you know, very accurate, and some of the things kind of are somewhat misleading. So I have some reflections on that. Certainly some sharing of some ephemera, some pictures that I took, and I think with a black and white two and a quarter camera. I promised the executive director that I'd show him what the tailings pile looked like from above in June of 1962, because he's spending more time than you'd like dealing with the tailings pile right now. I'd like to encourage you to share similar stories. Somebody who's been here in the 60s and 70s. And, were you here as guests or were you here as work campers?
I was working here for 3 weeks back in 69.
Okay. During the early summer, midsummer, late summer?
It was the late summer.
Okay. So Cloudy Pass was probably available to you in late summer if you wanted to go up there.
Correct.
Yeah. We ran into snow every time we tried it, so. What about you? Were you a work camper? Or?
No, our family of five came up here.
So you were a guest.
We were guests.
Okay, good. So if you've got stories, not just if you've got stories from the 60s and 70s stuff, but if you have stories that relate to this, the rule is you interrupt me. This is a conversation. This is not a PowerPoint that is on, you know, some sort of timing, things like that. It's very informal. So please share similar stories that you might have. Whether we get to them today or we get to them tomorrow, I've got some reflections on the church politics of the 60s, because they had an impact on Holden Village, believe it or not. The whole merger scene, how many of you were in the merged LCA or the ALC at the time that those mergers were going on in the early 60s, and it did have an impact, and it had an impact directly on Holden. I grew up in the Augustana Lutheran Church. I think technically it was the Augustana Evangelical Lutheran Church, which was the Swedish Lutheran Church. Both my grandmother and grandfather on my maternal side came from Sverige and immigrated to Spokane, and had my mother in Spokane. And so it was the place that my family was involved in leadership, and they were involved in building a new building there, and they were involved in being on the church council. It was where I had more friends than I had in high school or in Boy Scouts or in other organizations that I was in. So it really had a tremendous amount of impact on me. The Augustana Church, and other churches as well, but I can only speak for the Augustana Church, had a really strong emphasis on youth work. I think it was fairly unusual in the 1960s to have a full-time youth director. And Cheryl Robertson was, that was her job. Now, it wasn't a youth pastor. She was a youth director. She was trained by the Augustana Youth Organization that had been headed for many years before that and was headed at that time and is involved in the Holden story by Wilton Bergstrand. And their approach and philosophy was not so much to provide a program for youth to keep them occupied and to wear them out so they didn't cause trouble or, you know, make sure that they didn't do bad things. There was a leadership program, and it was designed, in effect, to teach young people how to lead and how to be involved and how to get things done, and things like stewardship and witnessing and all of that was critical. But we spent more time at seminars and leadership trainings and district conferences. I mean, Missoula, Montana, Salt Lake City, Seattle, PLU. That's the reason I went to PLU, is because I'd been to so many conferences up in Tacoma at PLU. Well, and that's also how I heard about Holden Village. They had a program. Anybody heard about or experienced the Caravanner program? Does that ring a bell with anybody? The Caravanner program? Interesting. How many people know that they came from a church that came out of the Augustana Church? Okay, so maybe this will be, I'll spend a little bit of time on it. They would take stars, and I mean stars, national stars. They put them in teams of four, and they had like two or three of these teams. And they were on caravans. And these four adults would come around, and they came to our church for a week and a weekend. And we had intensive programs, and we learned, and they would tell us what works and what doesn't, or what might work here. And they were consultants, they were trainers, they were inspiring. And it was through that Caravanner program that I heard about Holden Village. Now, this is now the beginning of my senior year in high school. I've just been elected president of the Luther League. It was time to be doing exciting things. I'd already done a lot of exciting things, and I'd heard about the Forerunners who were up here in the summer, very beginning of summer of 61. And again, that's not my program, but they slept outside. They didn't have a building that was habitable at all. And initially, they were cooking outside and sleeping outside. At least they got some building habitable for us when we came in the following summer. So there was an opportunity to be an Augustana work camper. And I wrote down some dates here. I talked my parents into applying because I told them there was no chance I would get accepted because they wanted college students and I wasn't yet a college student. I was between my senior year in high school and in college. Because I grew up in a family business and we ran a small trucking company in Portland. And I was always a pretty big, husky guy. And I talked my dad into letting me apply for this under the premise that I would never get accepted, hoping all the while that I would get accepted, because I used to work for him every summer. I also talked him into letting me apply for PLU in the same manner. He thought I would be going like to a cheaper school, and then I got accepted both at PLU and at Holden Village. Didn't work for him that summer. It's a nightmare. So, January 15th, I sent a letter, and I got a letter back from Wilton Bergstrand saying I appreciated my interest, and then on January, and I've got these letters, January 31st, I sent in my application. February 16th, I was accepted. On March, they sent me a packing list, and to give you just an idea, again, I'm not going to read everything in this file, but... So this was, I saved some of the paragraphs out of my application letter. Now, I'm not going to read you a lot of stuff because I'm a better writer now than I was when I was 17. I'm not a better speller now than I was when I was 17, and some of the spelling in my letters home are atrocious. And so this is the conclusion. In giving my reasons for wanting to work at Holden Village, I use the word give. First, in what I can give to Holden Village in the form of talent and hard work. Secondly, and equally important, is what Holden Village can give to me in the form of bringing me closer to Christ. Finally, all I can say is I am 6'2", 210 pounds, ready and able to work and sweat in Christ. I got accepted in 15 days. I kind of think that they had a shortage of guys. They had a lot of, and we ended up, in fact, with a group that had a lot more gals than guys. And then this is from Wiltney Bergstrand, February 16th. I'm happy to report to you that you've been accepted, so on and so forth. We look forward to working with you in this pioneering assignment. Let us even now pray daily that Holden Village may be a mighty instrument in the spiritual renewal of the church, and that the work camp days may be a time of physical, mental, and spiritual renewal for all, for all of us to share in them. We will send you the details later on. Write us if you have questions. And packing list has included things like sleeping bag, pillow slip, lots of blankets, one dress-up suit, and another casual dress-up outfit. We had to wear a suit and tie and, you know, white shirts when we went to church, and we had other times when we, in fact, had to kind of dress up. So that was important. But then work clothing, which was slacks, jeans, gloves, and so on, drip-dry shirts. Remember those? Warm clothing, because it gets down to 30 degrees at night. Good hiking shoes, and I blew that. My hiking shoes were terrible, and I had to get some new ones. Light raincoat, swimsuit, towel, washcloth, usual toilet articles, etc. Okay. They paid our expenses here once we got here, but we had to get here. And the list of people, actually took a summary here, in terms of geographic range, we had, you know, like, 7 from Minnesota and 5 from Illinois and a whole bunch from Iowa and North Dakota. There were very few of us west of the, you know, that was kind of from the Lutheran belt, if you will, of the upper Midwest that were around. So, I'm accepted. And I take off on the evening of June 10th. Well, they also distributed something you may have seen, which is, I can show it to you later, but it is the list of the minimum courtesies. And minimum courtesies is what the forerunners wrote out about, you know, men do not go into the women's quarters, girls do not go into the boys' quarters. I mean, they may have used different words. You know, the generator stops at 10:30. There'll be a flash of the light at 10:25. You know, you don't leave without three people. The same rules now. These were literally established by the forerunners. So, the evening of June 10th, 1962, I got on a Greyhound bus in downtown Portland, 12-hour trip, miserable trip, to Chelan, get there basically at dawn, and met the boat. The bus literally met the boat, and my recollection, having gone through Chelan, is that, and I can't confirm this, but now the dock is kind of a block and a half away from right where the bridge is, right at the river in downtown, and they said it was at the, quote, city dock. That's where we were to meet it. And my recollection is it was right at the foot of that street. So don't know for sure one way or the other about that. And then, of course, at that time, it was a four-hour boat trip. The Greyhound bus was $18.76. Now, am I a bit compulsive for actually having a copy of my Greyhound? Yes. And knowing that it was $18.76. Round trip, however. So it cost almost as much, you know, to get to Lucerne as it did to get to Chelan, because that was $4.10. Our daily schedule, which I don't know how, I don't think this has changed that much for people who are workers, depending on their job, but they made it very clear before we even came up here. 6:15, devotions. 6:30, breakfast. 7 o'clock, clean rooms. I was still eating breakfast, so I hardly ever got to cleaning my room. 7:15, actually, they listed it as 7:12, show up for work assignments, 7:15, begin work. So, I mean, it was like, you know, ring the bell, kind of. It was going. 9:30, we took a break, and that break was Kool-Aid and peanut butter sandwiches almost 90% of the time, so the peanut butter tradition was probably started back then as well. 12:45 or 1, we had what I would refer to as a hearty supper, because it was kind of, again, the Midwest approach to things, where you worked really hard really early in the cool of the day, and then in the afternoon you did study, you did Bible studies, and a variety of other kinds of things, including cleaning your room. So that was the hearty time, and then with all the other kind of activities in the evening, which included song fests and Bible studies and vespers and such, it was lights out at 10:30, and when I say lights out, they turned off the generator. It was lights out. Now, in 1962, the Unfolders, as we would later name ourselves, they didn't name us going in. We had the honor of doing that about 2.5 weeks into the process. We came from the Augustana Synod. We were scheduled to be here from June 11th to July 2nd. And that was going to be a significant work period. And the person who put this all together basically was Wilton Bergstrand of the Augustana Synod Youth Office, and Gil Berg, who had come, he was an ALC member and a member of the board of Lutheran Bible Institute, now Trinity College up in Seattle, that was involved in the original gift. And said, well, you know, let's have a full summer, not just the 1 month of the Forerunners, let's have a full summer. And let's involve the Augustana Synod, which had this, you know, vibrant youth program. Let's involve the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, the newly merged ALC, which merged in 1960, and also the Lutheran Free Church. They were all committed to have sent work campers throughout the summer. And so we were scheduled to end on July 2nd, but the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod was unable to meet their commitment. The others did. The unfolders, I do have the list here. We had 21, we were supposed to have 21 women and 21 men and 5 staff, but the real numbers ended up being more like 28 women and 18 men, so the shortage of men theory about how I got accepted is probably fairly accurate. But that's the most accurate list that I have, because some people were accepted and couldn't make it. They had to go to college, do something, get summer school, etc. The village staff, not the professional staff for the unfolders, but the village staff, are people's names that if you've been around Holden at all, you've heard in the history. And they were there, and I have them, at least several of them, signed one of my little things that I had people sign. Gil Berg, who was a Seattle business person and one of the really the driving forces of making this happen, referred to often as the mayor. He was the operations guy. He made the trains run on time. We didn't have any trains, but he made things happen around here operationally. He was CEO of his own company. He was basically CEO here. And Berta Pearson was the head cook, and she was a sweetheart, and you can tell that I like to eat. And so I got to know Berta, and Berta got to know me by our first names, because they didn't have the thing about the dining hall being open, you know, all day and all night and that kind of stuff. That would have been wonderful for me. And so, you know, I could go to the back door and kind of talk my way into the kitchen and maybe get a snack before or afterwards. And Rube Thompson, just Rube or Reuben, and his dog Bugger, and you hear those names and you read those names in history books, you say, oh, no, that's a history. That's a fictional character. No, he looked and acted like a fictional character, but he was real, and he had an old pickup, and I actually have a picture of his pickup going down the road to Lucerne. The Augustana staff for us was Dr. Wilton Bergstrand and his wife Dolores, and I was reading in the newest book, which is a kind of a memoirist book of a collection of remembrances from executive directors and other staff, and it's fascinating. And her name, I strongly believe, because I've seen her name in other publications, is spelled incorrectly there. That's what I was talking about, minor errors. Because she uses what I would think is the Spanish spelling of D-O-L-O-R-E-S, and the book says D-E. It's a common mistake. Fern Van Cura, who was a registered nurse, and then there were 3 adult leaders that were really just older students. They'd been in college a couple of years, but they were listed as leaders. But they quickly just kind of merged with us. We kind of became just sort of one group of people. Dolores Bergstrand, a delightful woman, but one of the most fascinating aspects of this, one of the strongest memories of the dining hall. Okay, you know what a marimba is?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, you know, it's like almost like the accordion lady of Spain kind of thing. I mean, because the things are flying, the little hand. I don't even know what do you do with a marimba, but she played the marimba, and so they hauled a marimba up here and had it in the dining hall, and that was our entertainment. I mean, we had other song fests and things like that. We had piano players and lots of other things going on, but she would play the marimba, and they have caricatures of her in his autobiography showing her playing the marimba, and that is in fact true. So, let me give you just a few of, these are all lists of the actual members of the team. These are song fest sheets and poetry sheets. Not going to read you poetry or sing. but for example, and this is all from one session. So we have here a song sheet of the Holden Village song sheet. And for those of you who are veterans of more current Holden Village, you can tell me whether or not these are even if they have lasted and gone on, or if things are completely changed. So, for example, the Holden theme song, I'll tell you more about that. I'll skip that over. The Holden work song was sung to, you know, Valderie, I love to work among, I'm just going to read it. I love to work among the pines upon this Holden task, and thus to serve our God and King beneath his clear blue sky. And then Valderie, we work and grub and sweat and scrub our shoulders to the task, so others may draw near to God beneath his clear blue sky, Valderie, and so on. Remember, as a song sung to the Gustavus Adolphus College song, the Holden Hello song. H for hi, we're glad you're here. O for O, look at the view. L for life, so bright and clear. D for dawn and dear and do. E for every open heart. N, you'll never want to go from this lovely place apart. Holden welcomes you, hello. H-O-L-D-E-N, hello. Now, are any of those done now? I mean, I
go.
Okay, well, you might want to reprise all of these. Dr. Bergstrand's favorite song was from the old Swedish folk tune, which the it's How Great Thou Art, or no, I'm sorry, oh my, oh, I'm blanking. Then sings, my soul, almighty God,
that's
to
it.
Thee,
yeah.
How
that's
great thou art. So he ended up, and it was had a copyright on it, and he didn't like the fact that it had a copyright on it, so he went and got somebody to translate it from the original Carl Boberg. And so he somehow thought he avoided copyright, and then he wrote extra verses for Holden. And so whereas now, I hadn't been back in 50 years, so I didn't know where we were going to stop, if we were going to be greeted. We would stop in front of Chalet 1 when people came in, and we would sing this song and hello and all these others to people instead of, you know, waving and saying hello. And like I said, I'm going to make copies of this for everybody. And then there's poetry that was written by Gil Bird. And there was a poem about Rube for Christmas. Everybody knows that Reuben, who was the caretaker, he was up here all alone for Christmas time before they had programs in the wintertime. So he had to celebrate Christmas alone. So we had, you know, on 1st of July or 4th of July, we had Reuben's Christmas. That was part of the celebration. So there's a big, long poem, and I write on here, spent one work morning at mind level helping to write this. So there was probably some work that didn't get done as a result of that. Okay, now I'm going to just read a few things off of this list. This is what was actually accomplished during the times we were here. Surveyed for generator, tapped gasoline supply, put in pump, moved large oil tank, hauled diesel fuel, bored up bridge, then unboarded, put new floor and railing on footbridge, boarded up one side of dorm porch, boarded up the mine, patched up the bridge by the pilings, cleared some of the mine area. That's 10 of, you know, 100 different items that were accomplished over a longer period of time, because again, one of the churches was unable to actually make it. Some other work trips, and they were work trips. Every time we went someplace in the way of hiking, we did it to either fix the trail or fix a bridge, or in the case of Lyman Lake, to clean out the cabin. How many people here have been up to Lyman Lake? That's the So, okay, we got some people who know what I'm talking about then. The shelter at Lyman Lake is still there? Is there a shelter up there? Is there a shelter up there?
No.
Oh, I'm crushed. Well, we had to go up and clean it out. That was the excuse for an overnight trip to Lyman Lake. Copper Basin, Holden Lake, Honeymoon Flats, Heart Lake, Lyman Lake. And then we failed on several occasions to actually get up to Cloudy Pass and to Mirror Lake. Now, before I get any further, since some of you are actually going to be leaving tomorrow, I'm just going to pass this around. These are the actual photos. There's only one of me, and it's this one, and I'm the guy in the far right over there. I'll pass this around so you can see it, and I've got some enlargements. There are five guys here, and this was one of our little sub-teams. We called ourselves the Four Horsemen. Nine of us. All right, there's five guys, and we call ourselves the Four Horsemen. I didn't get very good grades, okay, so, but it really doesn't, the five horsemen sound kind of weird, and so we were the four, and we worked on the road, you know, we were literally putting in guardrails and, you know, all that kind of stuff. So let me just, here, we'll start with you, and you can pass it back there. We've got, another 10 minutes or so on that, and then I'll pass this around from the other direction, and these are blow-ups of some of the photos that are taken there, and so, and they're just, you know, there's the tailing pile, 1962, there's the mine, and standard picture from the Lyman Lake switchbacks back looking at Hart Lake. There is what I was talking about in terms of the Lyman Lake shelter.
Oh, wow.
Now when you get this, you look at it, you notice it right here? I don't know if you can, I'm going to pass it around so you can see it. This is, I should have, in fact, scanned these and put them on a laptop. Taking a laptop to hold them, that was, I couldn't do it. I just couldn't do it. So this is up, you know, where a lot of snow falls, right? So if you notice this, there is this telephone pole, flagpole type thing. It's at least 30 feet in the air. And what's tied to the top of this is a shovel. And so the concept is you'd be up there snowshoeing or cross-country skiing or something like that, and you would see this shovel sticking out of the snow, and you would dig a tunnel down, and it goes right down to the front porch area of the shelter, and you would somehow or other be able to save yourself. So, and there is the shelter with all our packs on it. And then this, on the front steps of the community center or whatever, these are the unfolders. And then there's a bunch of proof sheets back behind there, but just kind of thumb through that. Let me just hand that and start that.
You want to start over there?
And if anybody's not going to be around tomorrow, they might want to raise their hand and get a copy of the book first on the chance that that would happen. One of the things that we had a talent contest. And talk about hilarity. Now, that word, I don't remember being used. It might have very well been used as early as 61 or even earlier than that. As you can tell, I'm kind of outgoing, sometimes to a fault. And so they said, you know, hey, Danny, why don't you put together some kind of a song group for the talent show? Anybody here over 60? Got some people over 60?
Oh,
okay. Good. Anybody who listened to rock and roll radio, you know, novelty songs and things like that? So I put together a group, and we sang Lollipop. Look at that. All right. And this is a quadrangle map, and it kind of became my high school annual, and I had everybody sign it. And several people in here say, Denny, sing Lollipop. And, you know, it's kind of inside code word. So, we all together now. Lollipop, lollipop, oh, lolly, 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 lollipop, lollipop, oh, lolly, 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 lollipop, lollipop, oh, lolly, lolly, lolly. And then we had, you know, unimaginable different scripts that dealt with Holden. The actual one, that the real song was, and this is kind of mundane, but Call My Baby Lollipop, Tell You Why, His Kiss Is Sweeter Than an Apple Pie, and When He Does His Shake and Rock and Dance, Man, I Haven't Got a Chance, Call Him Lollipop, Lollipop, oh, lolly. And we were encore after encore and won the talent contest. And so, you know, you can't shake a negative on something like that. And as I indicated, for anybody afterwards, or if we do a second, we're scheduled at 4 o'clock, you're welcome. This is a 1949 quadrangle that shows Holden Village and the list and the signatures of all of the unfolders and then their comments. Some of them are not very flattering. So I've pulled out the more flattering ones and typed them out, because these are hard to read. And so you could look at the more flattering ones if you wanted to, or you could look at the original if you like. Real quickly on a couple of things that I'll just skip over lightly because we're running out of time today and I want to cover a lot of little topics, and then I got a whole other hour. That was the year that we had the biology seminar from PLU up here, Dr. Laris and several other PLU professors. They all got to stay in the hotel. And it's my recollection visually that at that time you could see kind of the balcony behind up above the kitchen. But that may be another camp in another world. So don't trust me on that. But they did have hot water. And the drama troupe had hot water. And the guys stayed in Chalet 3. And we did not have hot water. Okay? It's as simple as that. It was very cold, and taking a shower was very problematic. Women stayed in the hospital and other chalets. I believe they had hot water. Gilbert was in Chalet 1. Bergstrand and his family were up like 8 or 9, because I had a long conversation with him one afternoon about John the Baptist, a book he was working on, and I don't remember specifically what chalet, but he was up in that area. Daily Bible study, regular Vespers, full-on Sunday worship. And I noticed when I went to Vespers last night, remember, I haven't been back in 50 years, we had it set up traditionally facing the stage. Every picture you look at in all the history sections show it faced up the way it is now. Fire, just like now, back then, this will be my last little anecdote, it was a very, very important thing. So one of the very first things we did was have a lecture on fire. And I believe that John Hill, who was, we called him the fire chief, had been a forerunner. I'm not sure of that. But he did know about firefighting. He knew about fire hoses and 2.5-inch fire lines and, you know, the dangers and all that kind of stuff. And so we started training right away. And in the very first 2 or 3 days, we had several drills. Now, I don't know if anybody knows this, but when you put full pressure to a 2.5-inch fire line, fire hose, put a nozzle on the end of it, that thing is a monster, and you've got to have 4 or 5 really good people on there in order to be able to control it. And we learned how to do that, and we were getting kind of cocky. And it was very sexist, because the ladies controlled the valve, and they were told that was really an important job, and it was, but the big, beefy guys all were hanging up. And so we were very cocky. We had drills, and we had a fire drill on the evening of June 14th, 1962. I remember that date because it was the date I was supposed to be at my high school graduation, but I had come here instead of going through my graduation. And I remember it also because it was the first one at night. And we did all right, got the hoses out. We'd run to the back door of the dining hall, because that's where the siren was, a wind-up kind of siren. And then John would say, "The fire is over there." And it was over here at the corner of the property, basically, at the far end of the road, and the fire was supposedly in one of those dorms. But it was dark. It was night. But again, we were cocky, confident, we knew what we were doing, and so the hose comes on, and he says, and then we're getting it, and he says, "Okay, you're doing all right." He says, "Now, we need to have you move laterally over here, and then hit it from the other side of the building." Well, it was dark, and somebody tripped, and then the other person tripped over that person, and then all of a sudden, and this brass nozzle, I got to be careful, because everything looks a little different when you come back after 50 years. It was a big hunk of brass at the end of this snake. And it started to do... And we had been trained for that, and we were told, run away from it. No, don't try to catch it. It'll eat you alive. And so we did. We turned and we ran away from it. But in the process of turning and running away from it, it had swung around and it came and hit this gravel, you know, sandy kind of road. And it just shot me in the face with all of this rock and sand. Yeah. And afterwards, for example, my clothes were just coated and impregnated with sand. And it shot a little tiny rock into my throat and down my throat. And so I won't share it with you now, but if you like, I've got it here. But I'm writing about this back to my mom about this happening. And I get the fastest response I had the entire 5 weeks I was up here from my mother. You know, "What happened to the rock?" I said, "I don't know. It might have come up, it might have come out, but it isn't causing any problems, and so I'm not going to worry about it." And we were less cocky about handling 2.5-inch fire hoses after that. And we were, and I would assume now that the firefighting skills up here are pretty good with your staff, and it's still incredibly important. So other things that I'll talk about tomorrow at 4, I think it is, in the same location. I'm going to talk about how we did adjust to the Missouri Synod not being available. I'm also going to talk about a very important to me, leadership skill that was taught me about bringing in skilled, trained volunteers to work with less trained but very skilled volunteers. Wilton Bergstrand created a program called the Eagles, which stayed here the entire summer. We'll talk a little bit about that. My boots falling apart, the famous, if not infamous to my family and friends, chapstick story. My stone bruises, finding a washing machine in what was the hospital, and now, incredibly ironic, is the ironic and a story for tomorrow, is falling in love with someone who was in fact housed there and spending time on the far end of the porch, that porch that comes out, that's really a mess, by the way. I'd like to help clean that up, because it just doesn't look romantic back there any longer. and falling in love back there. Oh, thinking that it would be fun to go for a swim in Lake Chelan, because we were driving this flat rack truck back and forth, literally hauling guests in the back of a truck along with their luggage. And so the five horsemen, four horsemen, whatever, we said, oh, it's hot, it's dusty, let's go for a swim. Lake Chelan is cold. I mean, we went in and came out in almost the same kind of thing. Did a lot of work up on the mine level, and we'll talk a little bit about that and how interested I was in the executive director's briefing yesterday on what's going on now with the remediation. Falling in love with Karen. Now, how can you resist? I'm sorry, those of you who are leaving tomorrow and are not going to be here at 4 o'clock, write me a letter, and I'll tell you about falling in love. At 17, it seemed really easy. You know, I don't know about that, but it did. And then losing track of her, and then finding her again, and now we're really very good friends. She's the Southwest Administrator of the World Mission Prayer League, the closest thing to a Lutheran nun I've ever found. And she was so committed to the church and to missionary work. And then some conversation about the mergers and some of the politics of the church back then and how that affected Holden Village and how Wilton Bertrand was involved in that. So I've left just a couple of minutes here to promise you less than an hour for questions that might have come up in anticipation of Saturday, if you want to wait for then or talk to me in the dining hall. Any thoughts or questions or stories that you can share from the 60s and the 70s that are as good as swallowing a rock? No, you can... Lollipop, whatever you've got.
Was Wes Preeb on the scene?
Was Wes what?
Wes Preeb here when you were here?
No. As I understand it, and I got a little more information from a book that's available at the bookstore that I read just literally today, he pretty much wrote a lot of letters and enjoyed writing a lot of letters to people asking him for things. It'd be interesting if his family still has a box of letters. He probably wrote to every corporation in the world, but he had his heart in the right spot. But then he was in Arizona or someplace, some Indian mission, by the time even the Forerunners were here, I believe. But he was also like a year-long, he was the first caretaker. Is that correct, to your knowledge? Mm-hmm.
He was in the pool hall when we were here.
Okay, well, that was after all of the initial starting up kind of thing.
Last summer when there were Forerunners here, they talked about him being here. I thought it was for a few years as a caretaker or something like that.
What was happening was, you know, when Gilberg and others from LBI came up here, and, you know, I've been in development a long time, and nobody in their right mind would accept this gift for a lot of reasons. Two and including what I still call Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, which are now called number one, number two, and number three. But that's what we called them back then, the tailing piles, because who knows what kind of danger was involved in that. And again, as a development director, you would say no, which they tried to do, and then things happened and changed all of that. But then there was problems of people running off with things, and so they had to have somebody here full-time. My understanding is he did that for one winter and then said, this is not really fun, it's spooky up here. But he had a revelation, and the sun shines through the window, and it's in the book, over in the bookstore. So go spend some money with it. Yes?
What situation was Lucerne at that time? Were there people living in those cabins, or just summer visit?
I actually have a brochure from that time that you're welcome to look at, that I grabbed. Obviously a much smaller footprint than it is now. There was a little shack that you could buy soda pop in, and we didn't have soda pop up here. I'm a popaholic. And so I'd go down there and buy soda pop, and that also fits into the chapstick story. There is a picture in this of a man standing by the dock at Lucerne, but not the other direction. And also, they were not hurting. What do you do with logs that are floating in the water when you've got a little boat that pushes them around? So evidently, there was logging going on, and they were making log rafts to tow down Lake Chelan. I have a picture of that as well. One of the things we did on our accomplishments list was to repair and make workable the, quote, telephone line to Lucerne, which was a kind of thing. In the basement of Chalet 2, I believe it was, which is the one that burned down, there was an old Stroger switch telephone system that was internal to the village only. And we had a telephone guy up here, and I knew enough to go in there and bother him and get in his way. But it was a... you know, with the dials, and there was about 10 phones around the village, and that's how they communicated. Now we've got all sorts of higher tech stuff going on around us. And again, on Saturday, with another 45 minutes to an hour to talk, I will allude a bit to how this really did change my life. I mean, this is, even though people say, well, why didn't you come back for 50 years? I got real busy, really busy. I mean, I was trying to make money to pay tuition and trying to, you know, get a job and trying to make a marriage work and all those kind of things that people do. And there wasn't really vacations, per se. And now I'm retired, and the 50th anniversary came along, and I wrote one of the program coordinators up here, and she didn't know what an unfolder was and thought it'd be good if I talked a little bit about it. And since I collect all this stuff,
that's good.
It was reasonably worthwhile. But it didn't change my life as much as it really did enhance, especially the areas of leadership school, and I mean leadership itself, and the ability to work with large teams of volunteers who really care about something. So it was a really a mountain, if you pardon the pun, a mountaintop experience for me in terms of being here. Yes?
You believe that it increased your faith?
You know, absolutely. And I've always been one of these faith people who, I'm the real Thomas. You know, I want to see the holes and I want to see the scar and that kind of stuff. And I want to logically figure it out and all that kind of thing. When you're surrounded by people who are very, very bright, very hardworking, very successful, and you begin to model after that, yeah, you do grow. Now, I'm still one who works hard at it all the time, and I've learned that that's okay, and I feel comfortable with that. But yeah, the Bible, I write, you know, a letter to my mother, okay, and I won't pull it out right now, but I said, you know, the Bible studies are nothing like I've ever experienced. It's totally different. And it was. And it was totally different because somebody had really spent a lot of time and energy, and they knew what they were talking about. Berge was a major expert on the theology surrounding John the Baptist and other related subjects. The singing. I love to sing. And even at Vespers here, you notice how it's not like at home where some are singing and some are not, and some are just following along. Well, we were a fairly small group with staff, and we began taking in guests that year. That's why I believe that they chose this as the 50th anniversary. We had an initial 3 weeks where we were not doing that, and then because the World Fair was going on in Seattle, we invited people to come on in, and we didn't know sometimes whether they were going to be here or not. They just would show up. We had to deal with it. And, boy, you get those people together with worship, and everybody is belting out that is very inspirational. So, absolutely. Absolutely. Yes?
Did they have a sauna back in 62?
No. No sauna, and one of the things on here is it says cleaned out the swimming pool, and you know that's all it says. And I was involved in that because the idea of swimming was a great idea, right? And it's right where the hot tub is now. The sauna was just the back of the dining hall, and it was an old swimming pool. And there's another structure, and help me out if anybody knows. There's another structure that looks kind of like a swimming pool that's higher up the hill above the hospital.
Yeah.
Actually,
12. Yeah. It looks like there's a little, like maybe it had a ladder going.
Yeah.
So it's not very.
Well, it looked kind of like that. Okay. And it was full of junk. And we said, well, this is a pool. Okay. So we cleaned all the junk out, got out a fire hose, which was probably a violation. You know, you don't touch the fire hose or the tools in the fire hose shed unless there's a fire. But we did. And we filled it up from the fire hose. Well, we're not thinking. We're 17. You know, and some of people are 18 and 19, so they're really smart. And where does the water in the fire hose come from? Well, it's actually colder than Lake Chelan, right? And it didn't warm up that much in that little swimming pool. But, you know, we stripped down to our shorts and went into that pool and came right back out, and that was the last time we were in that pool because there was no way of warming it up. Yeah, that was one of our accomplishments. Any other?
Well, to what extent did you have people, trained adults who knew how to do the things you were doing, like closing up the mine or fixing guardrails?
Well, we didn't go in the mine, first of all. That would be bad, bad, bad. Bergstrand did the year before. He had a miner take him in because he really wanted to see what it was all about, and he speaks of it in his autobiography. Not very much. We had some people who were electricians, and we had people who were plumbers who were teaching others to clean out. We thought that the trap on a pipe in a washroom that a miner worked in would be a perfect place for gold to precipitate out. Gold's heavy, right? and the water goes through, and it's just like painting. And so we were the ones who said we want to fix all of the sinks and all of the old dorms and things like that. And we'd collect all of this stuff.
Oh, you were really.
I was really 17. No, okay. Although I'd probably do that today. I gotta say, I'd probably do it today.
To find any gold?
Yeah. Well, and then I write home. Dear Mom and Dad, I haven't found any gold yet, but I'm still looking. But no, we didn't. We had, you know, obviously the generator and a diesel tank and things like that, but just going up on the roof of the school, which was basically our administrative headquarters in 62. It was where we had our meetings. It's where we would gather for work assignments. It's where we would check things off. And there was a TV antenna on top of the school. I don't know why. I don't know if they can pick up television or not. I read in one of these books that somebody bounced something off a glacier to pick up the assassination or something. But still, there was a TV, and we took it down. It was one of the things that's on the list. And working on the road, we didn't have any adult supervision. We had the five horsemen, and plus a couple here and there. And we were just the biggest and strongest guys. And the idea was that there was a guardrail that was out, and we had to, you know, dig out the hole and put the guardrail back in and tamp it down, and we knew enough to be able to do that. Yeah, it's a little scary when you think about it. Probably would not design it that way now, but the stuff we were doing was pretty basic. It was just heavy manual labor most of the time, trail building and moving wooden pipes and wooden things from the mine level out of the way so that they would not be in the way, and picking up scrap metal that might be dangerous and be... that might hurt someone. Well, that doesn't require an expert, except, hey, pick up the scrap metal up on the mine level. The more interesting question, and for those who didn't get introduced to Barbara, this is my bride of a couple of months, Barbara. The more interesting question would be, when the wind was blowing up there, did you inhale any of the tailings, and would that have maybe caused a problem? And I don't think that, it hasn't affected me at all, so I don't think there's a problem with that. We actually envisioned that we were clearing them off so that an airplane could land on them in an emergency, because the biggest one is actually long enough, as far as I'm concerned. But it was, at that time, it was still kind of moist and wet, had a kind of a puddle in it, and wasn't that flat. The smaller ones were dried up. But we did, go through the offices of the Howe Sound Mining Company. One of the things that I was looking for up in the kind of museum area of the recreation hall was a copy of an annual report from the Howe Sound Mining Company of the Holden Mine. Very complex fold-out sheets with showing how much was taken from what area and so on. And I believe I mailed it to someone, but we're still going through boxes and sorting out our stuff and things. And if I find it, I'll get it to the right person. But it was just laying around, core samples laying around. The research I did beforehand, and I believe that this is right, is, the raw ore would come out and it would go through these various ball mills and mechanical processes to crush it and break it up and then float off the valuable stuff or treat it in some way, and then the high-grade stuff is roaded on down the road. And so what was left is what's sitting out here in the tailing piles, which is not all that great of stuff to have next to a river. Okay, anything else? Yes, real quick.
The little place up here where there were houses, had they been burned by then?
The answer is I honestly don't know. We walked by it today because I wanted to go down and go to the open field. We used to have big campfires down in that open field at kind of the end of the road, if you will, before you get in the wilderness area. Had one so big that the Donkey Mountain Lookout drove up to see if the forest was on fire, so we had to make smaller fires after that. It is my impression that they bulldozed that down and burned it in the fall of 1961, and it was not there when I was here.
Okay.
Everywhere you read, it says it was done in the fall of 1962, which means it would have been there, and I would have seen it and walked by it, but it would have been off. You wouldn't be able to go in there. They would say, sorry, you can't go in there because it's dangerous. And there are other things that I have thought that I have remembered really, really well from 50 years ago that turned out to be different, so I'm not going to say one way or the other, but my recollection is they were all just foundations and grass growing, and now it's a forest. 50 years, a lot of difference for a tree.
Yeah.
Makes a big difference. But yeah, I'd love to get a real official Forest Service archivist that could look that up and make sure one way or the other. I don't think it's that important. Yes?
When did you decide to wait till your 50th year to come back?
That's, I was waiting for that question. The honest answer is I don't know, but life is so busy sometimes, and you've got so many priorities, so many things going on, and it is a long ways up here. I knew that Holden had changed over the years. I had tracked it through some of the leaner years and some of the more, let's call them even controversial years. And it got a combination of things came up. Number one, I had the ability and the time to spend to come up here. It was the 50th anniversary, and as far as I'm concerned, the organization is doing very, very well right now under the current leadership. And so it was not like going up and seeing something that you might not, that might not survive. I think this organization is going to do very, very well over the next 50 years and maybe 150 years or longer. I just never had a reason. I had all sorts of reasons. I just didn't have the time or the ability to make it happen. And this, I didn't come up. I mean, this was a bonus, being able to do this. When I talked to Cindy, and she said, well, then why don't you do this, this, this? And I said, okay, I got a box of stuff. I'll go through it. I'll find it all. All right, well, I promised you it would be shorter than this, so I'll let you all go. If anybody wants to talk afterwards, for those of you who want to come tomorrow at 4 o'clock, same place, and I got more stuff. So I don't run away with my